Thank you very much, Adam, for those words of introduction. As Adam said, I'm the Assistant Governor, Financial System, and in that remit is financial stability. And the way I like to describe concerns about financial stability is what we're worried about is tail risks. So we're not worried about... our monetary policy people and a lot of economists, they're talking about the central tendency, what's the most likely outcome. We're actually worried about tail risks. And so that's typically what we think about when we're thinking about financial stability. And, of course, we're a central bank that doesn't have responsibility for prudential supervision. So we think about financial stability very broadly, about what's going on in the balance sheets of banks, in financial institutions, but we're not a supervisor. That, of course, rests with the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority. But as Adam said, one of the things that is one of our outputs is this, which is the Financial Stability Review, and highly recommended reading for you all. So a couple of weeks ago, we released our October Financial Stability Review. And in that, we concluded that the Australian financial system looked pretty resilient. The Australian banks are well capitalised, they're profitable, and they've got sound lending standards, and they have plenty of liquid assets as well. And the major banks are also very close to meeting APRA's unquestionably strong capital benchmarks, which they set out earlier this year. So all of this is really good for the resilience of the banking sector in the face of any downturn, and therefore that's really good for financial stability. But where the banks stand today actually reflects changes to the international regulatory framework over the past decade. So the global financial crisis 10 years ago revealed inadequacies in bank capital and liquidity levels and in their risk frameworks. And this resulted in an international effort to increase the resilience of the financial sector, to make it more resilient to shocks. So banks around the world have been required to increase the level and the quality of their capital and to mitigate their liquidity risks. And systemically important institutions, so the really big global systemically important institutions and domestically important ones in Australia, for example, they're required to maintain additional buffers above the minimum requirements. So there's been a real push to get the ones that can impact systemic stability much more well capitalised. There's also, in addition to this, been a focus on better disclosure and transparency to give a bit more of an understanding on where the risks lie. Now, the Australian banks were actually much less affected by the GFC than many overseas banks. There were some examples where funding and asset quality became issues, but as a whole, the banking sector remained solid. But there were nevertheless lessons to be learned from the international experience. So over the past decade, the Australian banking system has, like the rest of the world, been transitioning to a more resilient position. And in my talk, what I plan to do is highlight some of the changes that have taken place. And then I'm going to finish up by talking a little bit about where future risks might lie. And then after that, I think I'm open for some questions. So I'll start on capital. Capital, as we all know, is in banks is there to absorb losses. And one of the lessons from the GFC was that globally, banks held too little capital relative to the risks they were taking. In some cases, high-profile cases, there simply was not enough capital to absorb the losses that resulted from the very extreme economic and financial conditions. And no doubt you can all think of some of the institutions that fell into those buckets. There's therefore been a concerted effort globally to increase the amount of capital and to improve its quality. And there's also been changes to make capital that is held more sensitive to the underlying risks of the assets. And at the same time, there's been a non-risk-sensitive leverage ratio introduced as a backstop to make sure that the absolute level of capital can't fall too low. These reforms, as many of you will know, are collectively known as Basel III, and they've been progressively introduced since 2013, and they're continuing to transition in for a number of years to come. So it's been quite a long transition process. So consistent with this, APRA has required the Australian banks to significantly strengthen their capital positions. The minimum capital ratios have been raised. They've re-examined risk weights and they've refined the risk weights. And they've introduced capital conservation buffers as well. And those banks that qualify as domestically systemically important banks, they're required to hold even larger buffers. Commonwealth Bank is, in fact, one of them, but the other three majors as well. And these measures have resulted in a significant increase in the amount of capital held by the Australian banking system over the past decade. So this graph here shows a number of things, but includes the risk-weighted capital ratios for the major Australian banks from the early 2000s to 2018. So you can see at the time of the GFC, if you look at the black line, Tier 1 capital, at that time of the GFC, the Tier 1 capital ratio was about 7% of risk-weighted assets. By 2018, this had increased to 12.5%. But in fact, the increase was higher than that because, in fact, in 2018, we measure capital ratios more conservatively than we did in 2007. So the blue line below it is the Common Equity Tier 1 capital ratio, which is a tighter definition of capital. It's more high-quality capital, typically only includes retained earnings and shareholder funds. And that's increased from around about 8% in 2013 when it was first introduced under Basel III. And for the Australian banks, the major banks now, it's around about 10.5%. And the way the banks achieved this was basically by direct equity raisings, some quite substantial equity raisings. They also added to capital from retained earnings, and we'll come on to profitability a little bit later. And they also added, they had dividend reinvestment plans. So all of these were building capital in the banking system with the resultant rise in the capital ratios. At the same time, though, as they've been raising their capital, of course, the denominator is risk-weighted assets. And at the same time as they've been raising the amount of capital, they've been actually lowering their capital-intensive exposures. So they've been lowering exposures for which they are required to hold more capital. They've been increasingly focusing on housing lending because housing lending tends to generate higher returns and is relatively efficient on capital. So you can see that in this graph here. So what the top focus on the top and the bottom. So the orange graph at the top is the risk weight on corporate exposures of the average risk weight on corporate lending for the major banks. And it's declined from around 80% in 2009 to around 55%. So what the banks have done, the major banks, is they have basically lowered exposures where they've attracted high risk weights. So that's meant the denominator has not grown, the risk-weighted assets. On the other hand, you'll see that mortgage risk weights are very low relative to corporate risk weights. So they've shifted to lower risk-weighted assets. You will see there's a rise in the mortgage risk weights there. The key reason for that, is that APRA actually increased the risk weights on housing lending in 2016. And this was mainly to address a recommendation from the Financial System Inquiry to try and decrease the difference in risk weights between the major banks, which operate model-based risk weights, and the smaller banks, which operate under a standardised risk approach. So two things going on. Capital raising going on, and at the same time, focus on reducing risk-weighted assets where they could. So this transition to the high-level capital is now coming to an end, and now that APRA have finalised their unquestionably strong framework, the major Australian banks, are going to be required to maintain their Common Equity Tier 1 capital ratios at least 10.5%, and they're very close to meeting those ratios now. This actually is a high ratio in both an absolute and a relative sense. APRA actually has a fairly conservative framework in the way they implement. Their risk weights tend to be higher. They have more restrictions on what can be included in capital. And so if you take into account the relative conservatism of APRA's approach, you'll see that Australia actually, 10.5 doesn't sound high, but it's quite high internationally. This graph shows you a number of things. So the purple bars are 2017 Tier 1 capital rates. So these are Tier 1 capital ratios, not CET1, for a number of countries. The purple bars show 2017, and the black dots show 2008. So that shows you that there's been an uplift in capital ratios for all countries around the world. The light purple bar in Australia's case basically shows you that if you put Australian banks' capital ratios on an internationally comparable basis, you add around about 400 to 500 basis points. So they've basically around about 17% rather than 10.5%. So we look very, very... If you just take our 10.5%, we don't look particularly high internationally, but if you adjust for the relative conservatism of APRA's approach, our capital ratios are high in a relative sense. So that sort of covers capital, but there was a whole lot of work also done on funding and liquidity. And part of the Basel framework arising from the lessons of the GFC was an introduction of measures to address risks inherent in liquidity and maturity transformation of the banks. And there was two particular things here. There was the liquidity coverage ratio and the net stable funding ratio, which were introduced. So the liquidity coverage ratio, many of you will know, is designed to ensure that banks have sufficient high-quality liquid assets that they could easily convert into cash to meet an intense liquidity stress scenario. And in practice, what that means is that they need to hold enough of these liquid assets to fully cover expected net cash outflows in a stress scenario lasting 30 days. So it's quite a high test. The net stable funding ratio was designed to mitigate the risk inherent in funding relatively illiquid or long-term assets with short-term borrowing. So it tries to prevent over-reliance on short-term funding by requiring banks to hold sufficient stable funding to fund their the liquidity, to match the liquidity characteristics of their assets. So consistent with the international framework, Australian banks have completed a transition to more stable sources of funding and holding more liquid assets. So APRA introduced the LCR in 2015 and the net stable funding ratio in 2018. And both of these apply only to larger banks. It's about 15 banks to which these apply. Smaller institutions don't have to meet these. And the Australian banks are all fully compliant with these requirements. But the introduction of the LCR, the liquidity coverage ratio, presented some practical difficulties in the Australian context. And for the international guests, this might be of interest. Australia actually has a very small pool of government and semi-government securities which constitute high-quality liquid assets for the purposes of the liquidity coverage ratio. So what Australia did was introduce a committed liquidity facility, and that's a facility that's available under the Basel III framework to help in jurisdictions where there is insufficient high-quality liquid assets. And what the committed liquidity facility does is enable participating banks to access a pre-specified amount of liquidity by entering into repurchase agreements with the Reserve Bank of particular eligible securities. And then for this facility to have access to the Reserve Bank, they're charged an ongoing fee. So it's like a conditional liquidity facility it's committed by the Reserve Bank, but it's conditional on the banks needing it in the event of a stress situation. Now, with the Australian banks' liquidity and funding profiles have changed substantially over the past decade. The banks' holdings of liquid assets, the major banks in particular, have increased from around 15% of total assets prior to the GFC to around about 18% currently. And a lot of this increase has been in high-quality liquid assets, so governments and semis, and a lot of it actually occurred in the immediate aftermath of the global financial crisis. But the new liquidity arrangements have certainly encouraged the move to financial institutions to hold more liquid assets. The other thing banks have done quite substantially over the last 10 years have increased the share of funding from deposits, which is a form of funding that is treated as a more stable form of funding. So this graph here shows you funding composition of the banks. The top is the share of domestic deposits, and then you'll see short-term debt below that in red, and longer-term debt in the purple, which are the things that I'll focus on. So over the past decade, the share of funding that has come to the banks from deposits has risen from around about 40% at the time of the GFC to around about 60% currently. And short-term debt funding has fallen from around 35% to about 20%. And at the same time, the banks have actually been increasing the duration of their debt. So this shows you the blue line. This is the original duration of the debt as it's issued. And then the red line residual is showing you over the stock of debt what is the current duration. And you can see that increasingly banks are issuing at longer durations, and that's having an impact on the duration of the stock of debt outstanding. And that reduces the frequency with which they need to go to funding markets. So that's good for stability of their funding. I wanted to move on now to profitability. So the banks have, obviously, they've got more capital, they're more liquid, they've got more stable funding, but what about their profitability? Profitability, sometimes I think people forget that a profitable banking sector is important for maintaining and building resilience of the financial system. As I noted earlier, retained earnings were an important contributor to the increase in capital in the banking system over the last decade. And now, in the event of an economic downturn, profits also give banks scope to absorb rises in credit losses without eating into capital. So this is a good thing for stability of banks and stability of the financial system. So the absolute level of profits of the Australian banks rose over the years immediately following the GFC. That reflected a couple of things. Mainly, it was relatively good conditions in Australia, which drove a decline in provisions for bad and doubtful debts. But there's also a strong growth in assets, primarily mortgages. And as I said earlier, they are relatively profitable and lower risk. Since 2014, however, profits have stabilised for the banks, and there's been a number of factors that have contributed to this slowdown in growth. There's been a decline in non-interest income. Banks have been, as you know, scaling back their fee-generating businesses, such as wealth management, selling it off, so there's been less contribution to profits from there. The benefits to profits from the falling bad and doubtful debts is also largely finished, and in fact bad and doubtful debts are slightly on the rise, so you're not getting any benefit from that anymore. At the margin, also, assets are growing a bit more slowly, and there's been some declines in net interest margin as well, which have contributed to slower growth in profits. Return on equity for the banks has fluctuated broadly in line with profitability in recent years, but with the rise in capital levels, it's lower than it was before the GFC. So this graph shows you some international comparisons. And you'll see that for Australia, the return on equity for major Australian banks has been about 12% over the past few years. It's a little higher than many overseas jurisdictions. The rates of return there average between 8 and 10, which are currently more common. But everyone is lower than they were before the GFC, and that reflects higher capital levels, but it also reflects, I think, that banks, they've been forced to be a little less risky, so you would expect lower returns. More recently, as we all know, there's been various inquiries into the financial sector, and these have highlighted to varying degrees cultural issues within the banks. International experience has shown that poor culture can have a significant adverse impact on banks, including on their financial performance and capital position, and that happens through remediation costs and also fines. And in fact, some of the really big negative returns in the UK and Europe reflect very large fines for some of the banks, reflecting their behaviour during the GFC. The Royal Commission has brought to light some poor behaviours by the Australian banks, but the direct financial impact on the Australian banks from that, I think, has been relatively modest so far. The fines to date have been relatively small compared with combined profits for the major banks of around $30 billion per annum. But there are costs from remediation of past behaviour, and we're seeing some of that reflected in banks' profit announcements in recent times. There's also the possibility of class actions, so there are some possible costs coming down the line. And there's also more likely to be increased costs of compliance, and they're going to be ongoing costs. They're not one-off. More broadly, there's been very little share price growth over recent years, and this has obviously had an impact on shareholder returns. And finally, there will be probably changes to business models to address the risk of future misconduct, and that could more permanently affect banks' financial performance. Having said that, all these changes are likely to increase the resilience of the financial sector in the medium term. So it might lower returns, but we've got a more resilient financial sector for that. So I think what I've tried to demonstrate here is that over the past decade, we've done a lot of work to improve the resilience of the banking system in Australia and indeed worldwide. But there's still some work to be done, particularly in the area of resolvability of financial institutions, what happens when they fall over, and the implementation in that context of what are known as loss-absorbing capital regimes. So there's a bit of work around the world and in Australia still to do there. But overall, we're in a much stronger place than we were in pre-GFC. So I want to move on briefly now to talk about non-bank financing, because with the increasing regulatory requirements on the banks in recent years, and in particular and since about 2014, guidance to tighten lending standards, there has been some shift in lending activity to the less regulated non-ADI sector. Now, I should point out that this is not necessarily a bad thing, because the non-ADI sector provides an alternative source of credit. Borrowers who might find themselves unable to borrow from a bank because the bank might assess them as not being within their risk appetite could go to a non-ADI lender and still get funding. And those non-ADI lenders might be prepared to take on the higher risk lending for a higher interest rate. This might remove credit constraints for some borrowers. The non-ADI lenders, of course, also can provide some competition to the regulated sector. And in fact, when the mortgage originators came into the mortgage lending business in the mid-90s, the resulting spread on housing loans actually declined quite a lot. So competitive pressure helps here. Nevertheless, you could have lending by the less regulated sector increasing what we'd call macro-financial risks. So these are the risks of build-up of risks in balance sheets. For example, the measures introduced by APRA over the past few years to try and address risks in household and banks' balance sheets, they could be undermined if the less regulated sector simply filled the gap that APRA, that the regulated institutions vacated. So the lending practices of this sector might exacerbate asset price cycles, which might have resulting impacts on balance sheets of the banks themselves if prices go up and come down very sharply. And also, if the regulated sector, the banks respond to competition from the non-ADIs by lowering their lending standards, then that could actually lead to a broad-based increase in risk. So that mightn't be a good thing either. I think it's been reasonably well telegraphed that lending by non-banks, particularly for property, particularly for residential property, has been growing quickly over the past couple of years as the banks have tightened their lending standards and raised their interest rates on loans to investors and for interest-only loans. So there's been a little bit of a shift and to the non-ADI sector there. A lot of this growth has been funded by non-bank issuance of residential mortgage-backed securities. And that's what this graph shows here. So you'll see pre-GFC there was a lot of non-bank issuance of residential mortgage-backed securities. They could do it reasonably cheaply. It was easy for them to do, and it was easy for them, therefore, to fund their lending. After the GFC, it became much more costly for them to do this, and there was a lot less activity in this sector. Since about 2014, you're starting to observe that they're growing their RMBS portfolios again. It's still below the levels of the GFC, but it's a sign that they're growing their market share here. I'd say so far the risks in this sector remain contained. It is growing quite quickly, but the debt financing of the non-ADI sector is only about 7% of total financial assets in Australia. So this is a slightly complicated graph, but really focus on the bottom bit is the deep purple. That's securitisation vehicles. So that's sort of the layer of mortgage originators that are financing their mortgages through issuing RMBS. And you can see that it's growing very quickly, but it's still relatively small at about 2 or 3% of total assets. If you add in hedge funds and money market funds, you get to around about 7% of financial system assets, but it isn't growing. So our reading on this is that although we're monitoring it, it still remains relatively contained, the risks here. We in APRA are continuing to monitor this, though, from a financial stability perspective. As part of its focus on lending standards, APRA has in fact been emphasising to the banks that they need to monitor the lending standards of the non-ADIs that they're providing temporary funding to, and they need to make sure that those lending standards are appropriate as well. And APRA now has some additional powers to collect more detailed data on the non-ADI sector, which will be helpful to monitor growth and risks. And also, if APRA judges that the non-ADI lenders as a group, not singly, but as a group, are posing a risk to financial stability, it has the power to make rules covering the lending of that sector. Now, we're nowhere near a threshold on that at all, but they're reserve powers that APRA could use to directly address some risks if they were to arise. So I want to finish up by talking a little bit about other risks. What are the other current potential risks now to financial stability? So on other occasions, I've talked a lot about household debt and the housing market, and I won't say much more here about that, but I would like to highlight some work that we've been doing to estimate the impact of APRA's prudential policy measures on the housing market. So we set this work out in a special chapter of our financial stability review. It's chapter 5, well worth reading. And it's an attempt at a quantitative analysis to try and use some econometrics to get at what is the impact of the prudential policy measures on the housing lending market. And what our analysis suggests is that when APRA introduced their 10% benchmark on growth in investor lending, it didn't really alter the total flow of credit, but it did in the year or so following that. But what it did do was alter the composition of the lending. It reduced loan approvals for investors quite substantially, but at the same time the market adjusted to this and loan approvals for owner-occupiers started to grow more quickly. So there was a switch in the growth of where the growth was coming from. And to the extent that investor demand exacerbates housing price cycles by chasing prices up and chasing prices down, if you have a configuration of lending standards that enables strong growth in lending to investors, then that could be unhelpful for financial stability. So at the margin, the policy of trying to contain growth to investors has probably eased the financial stability issues. And we show, I think, in the special chapter as well, that this is supported by some evidence that the benchmark contributed to a slowing in the growth of housing prices much more in regions that had high shares of investors. So the prudential measures weren't aimed at housing prices. That wasn't what they were aimed at. But at the margin, they seem to have impacted more in high investor regions than in lower investor regions, and that's probably at the margin good for financial stability. So there's two other risks I wanted to mention in the FSR and highlight. They're cyber risks and external risks. So I don't think a day goes by now without some mention of cyber risk somewhere, either in the media, on the news, or whatever. It's a fairly regular topic in financial sector conferences these days, and it's an increasing focus for regulators. So cyber risk is the threat of financial losses or disruption or reputational damage from a malicious breach of a firm's information systems. And it can manifest in a number of different ways. It could be theft of data. It could be system disruptions. It might be manipulation of data in systems. Or ultimately, it could be theft of money, financial attacks. And cyber attacks are becoming more organised and more sophisticated. Not surprisingly, given their central role in credit provision and holding deposits, financial institutions are high on the risk of entities that are at risk from cyber attacks. And I'd have to say that financial institutions are well aware of the risks and they invest appropriately in this. In fact, one simple measure of this is to count how many times the word cyber is mentioned in the annual reports of the major Australian banks. And if you go back to 2012, the word cyber was not mentioned in any annual reports at that time. In 2017, there were 30 mentions of the word cyber in major banks' annual reports. So it's a risk that's continuing to rise, and it's actually going to require continued vigilance and investment in mitigation into the future. But could a cyber attack have implications for financial stability? A successful attack on a financial institution could result in a significant loss for that financial institution. And you might well remember the attack on Bangladesh Bank, for example. That resulted in a loss of around about $81 million US dollars. It could have been much larger, but the loss was $81 million. Could a financial loss of that sort of magnitude have systemic consequences that threaten the stability of the financial system? I think that's probably unlikely. But an attack could impact the integrity of the data held by a financial institution, and that could affect its ability to operate. A successful attack could result in lack of confidence in the banking system more broadly, potentially resulting in people withdrawing their funds or attempting to withdraw their funds, and that could result in liquidity issues for the banks. If an attack disrupted payment systems, it could cause significant difficulties for households and businesses and disrupt the economic activity. And a disruption to the settlement of transactions for an extended period could cause issues for the operations of markets, and it could result in a build-up of significant settlement risks in the financial system. I think these are all really unlikely outcomes, but the regulators are nevertheless focusing on how financial institutions are mitigating the risk. And it's not just about prevention, it's about detection, response and recovery from these sorts of attacks. So the second risk that I'd like to highlight is the global environment. So at the moment, we've got solid growth in Australia and around the world. We've got relatively stable financial markets. And these have been supporting financial stability in Australia over the past year. But as you might have heard in some of the presentations, compensation for risk worldwide remains very low. Asset prices are at very high levels, reflecting very low levels of risk-free rates, and markets are vulnerable to a sharp increase in risk sentiment, which would have implications for banks' offshore funding and their assets. Global growth might contract sharply for a number of reasons. It could be escalating trade tensions or financial instability in China. And those circumstances that would impact us, we might get some offset from a depreciating exchange rate, but there would be implications for the Australian economy and potentially impact the highly indebted household sector as well as bank balance sheets. So recent policies to strengthen lending standards will help to guard against widespread financial stress, but there is a risk that if the downturn was significant enough, the financial impact on the banks and on the borrowers would amplify the initial shock, and that would have broader what we call macro financial implications. So in conclusion, the Australian banks have largely completed a decade-long transition now to stronger capital and liquidity positions, and that's made them much more resilient to adverse shocks than prior to the GFC. This transition has seen a change in business models and a decline in returns. And the recent focus on tightening lending standards has further improved the resilience of both bank and household balance sheets. But there are some risks that remain. While lending to the less regulated sector, the non-ADI sector remains small, lending by that sector remains small, it's increasing quickly and it is higher risk. So, and also risks from the external environment are high. And operational risk, I think, has been shown, particularly in the form of cyber risk, is increasing. So we at the Reserve Bank and other regulators, as well as the banks, need to remain vigilant. So I'll finish there. Thank you.
you were prepared to take some questions. So I didn't advertise it, I don't think, ahead of the lunch, but we do have an app, and there are various questions that come through. One of them from the audience here is, the Assistant Governor spoke about lending from non-regulated ADIs, but has the RBA done work on deposit payment platforms, thinking about competition from fintech that is happening in other countries?
Sure. Let me make a point straight up. I've talked a lot about financial stability, and I mentioned that profitability is good for banks. But we also mustn't forget that competition is also good, because competition delivers good outcomes for consumers. So competition from new entrants into these into the market, I think, is a very positive thing. And what the regulators really need to focus on is how do you encourage innovation, encourage competition, while at the same time protecting depositor funds. So this is APRA's primary goal, is to protect depositor funds. I think the way we're trying to do it internationally and in Australia, there's been a number of leads on that. There's lots of transitional arrangements. So around the world, we have various regulatory sandboxes where new entrants can come in and try out their offerings, transition themselves into a position where they can meet more fully the regulatory requirements. APRA and ASIC have similar sorts of sandboxes in Australia. I think it's a very positive thing, and I think open banking is another very positive thing for competition, because I think it's very easy for consumers to sit back, and it's quite hard to move financial institutions, which makes it a little bit easier perhaps to for the barriers to moving, and therefore the barriers to competition are a bit high. I think the promise of fintech and some of these new innovative platforms is to perhaps lower the barriers and make it easier for consumers to in fact move. So I think personally that the fintechs, along with the open banking initiatives, are going to make it a reasonably interesting time in banking land.
Another question here. There's a lot of stories in the press about housing prices, but so far the declines look quite orderly and even welcome. But they're clearly a risk factor. At what point do these price falls start to worry the RBA more and become a real threat to the economy and financial system?
Sure. The housing market a few years ago was getting lots of attention because prices were going up too quickly. Now they're coming down, I think, in a reasonably orderly fashion. And I think there's a little bit of... I find it quite amusing in a way that there's a lot of concern that prices are coming down when a few years ago everyone was concerned that they were going up too quickly. I wouldn't put a number on it, but I would make a couple of points. The first is that the rate at which it comes down probably matters. So if you had a 10% decline over 2 months, that looks very different than a 10% decline over a year. So I think the duration of it, I think, makes a difference. I think from a financial stability perspective as well, what we're interested in is household and bank balance sheets. These housing loans are very well secured by the banks. Bad and doubtful debts are very low. They've risen a little bit. Housing loan arrears have risen a little bit, but that's mainly due to Western Australia, which has had some very challenging economic conditions. But they may remain very, very low, and they are very well secured. So I think that even if housing prices come down a bit more, I think on average, historically, they might come down 10% or so on average. If they come down by that much, it's not going to have a large impact on banks' balance sheets. Households as well, I think, generally have not borrowed the maximum amounts that they were eligible to borrow. So there's good reason to think that the households are in a reasonable position to handle that. And owner-occupiers, really, unless you're a distressed seller and you've bought at the peak, you're probably still going to be in a reasonably good position. So we are obviously concerned about that. We're concerned about perhaps the cycle in housing prices being amplified and that leading to a sort of a domino effect, if you like. But at the moment, there's no signs of that happening.
Any questions from the floor? Yep, here.
Michelle, thank you over here, for your insights. I'm just interested in your thoughts about Aussie dollar funding stresses we've seen. I mean, we've seen short-term funding stresses offshore in particular over the year, but pockets of Aussie dollar funding, I think largely linked to offshore holdings of assets, some of which I think might be linked to risk-weighted assets being sold down in Australia, where they're kind of going. Obviously, that's flowing through to some of the domestic short-term Australian domestic markets. Do you see that as a... We obviously see that as a commercial risk. Do you see that as a financial stability issue? How does the RBA stand on that?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting question, and we talked a little bit about in the financial stability review. I'll preface my remarks by saying I'm not a financial markets specialist, and they obviously are much more involved in the detail of this than I am. There were some special factors in the initial run-up, which were related mainly internationally, but Australian funding rates haven't come down. BBSW spreads, for example, haven't come down by as much. And part of that does seem to be associated with perhaps some of the regulatory liquidity changes. That in and of itself I don't think poses particular financial stability risks, but we do mention in the review that... to the extent that it might indicate that in periods of stress the markets might find it a little more difficult to adjust, then it's something that certainly we will be keeping our eye on.
Michelle, with respect to the committed liquidity facility, what assets can the banks repo into that, and under what circumstances can they repo into that, and has it been tapped since?
Sure. It hasn't. So basically what most of them do is that they hold self-securitised mortgages on there. So they're not high-quality liquid assets, but they hold self-securitised. Most of the banks hold self-securitised mortgage assets on their balance sheets, eligible to be repoed with the Reserve Bank for liquidity at appropriate haircuts and so on. The conditions in which that would be... So there's a process every year in which the Reserve Bank looks at the stock of high-quality liquid assets out there, makes a judgment on what portion of that can be held by banks without affecting the liquidity more broadly of the market. So the idea is that if we don't have enough and they're all held by the banks, there's no liquid market in it, and that's clearly defeating the purpose. So the bank makes a judgment on that. APRA makes a judgment on how much high-quality liquid assets the banks require for the purpose of the LCR, and then we make up the difference basically by this committed liquidity facility. To use it, you have to APRA has to approve it being used, and the bank has to be... happy that the bank itself is in a solvent position and a going concern, and it hasn't been tapped. But there's a whole process around it. It's something that's able to be done in terms of the Basel III framework, particularly aimed at jurisdictions where the supply of high quality liquid assets was not enough to meet the regulatory requirements. It is, and they pay for it.
It's in conflict with responsible lending?
No, because they're responsible lending. So I think we just have to make a distinction between the liquidity rules and the supervision and the capital side of things. So the liquidity is all about addressing the concerns that in stress period, the bank may be solvent, but because of the drain on liquidity, they've got to have enough liquid assets to meet those requirements. I think the issues about responsible lending, if you're talking about responsible lending from a consumer perspective, typically that's an ASIC thing, But if you're talking about lending standards and banks applying appropriate lending standards, that's addressed through APRA's supervision of the financial institutions, and also ensuring that the banks in their modelling of their, in order to generate their risk-weighted assets, that banks are taking appropriate account of the probability of default and the loss given default. So I think all those things are more combined in the supervision space and the capital space. The liquidity, I think, is a separate thing. I don't think it contributes to them being loose.
There's another question over there on the right.
Michelle, thanks for your speech. I have a question on interest-only lending. When interest-only loans convert to principal and interest loans, the repayment typically increases significantly. Has the Reserve Bank done some research on how much of that increase in repayments is a risk to consumer spending?
Yeah, good question. So we have done a little bit of work on that. Couple of things. So that the work we've done, and we have a securitisation database, so part of the side effect, if you like, of the committed liquidity facility, that we actually have a whole lot of data on the loans that banks have securitised that would be repoable to us. And although it's not a full set of the market, it gives you a pretty good idea of loan, individual loans and the conditions in which they're made, loan balances, incomes, these sorts of things. So what we know from that information and from liaison with the banks is that generally there's three categories. There's people who, when their interest-only period expires... Well, let me go back a step. There's people who, when interest rates went up, thought, you know what, I'm going to move to a principal and interest now. And the feedback we have from the data and from banks is that those people are managing things just fine. And in a way, it's not surprising because from about 2014, APRA was requiring banks to measure serviceability based on those higher principal and interest payments. So they weren't measuring serviceability based on interest only. And they were also requiring people, banks, to take into account and incorporate buffers into loans, interest rates on other debt. So that there's actual buffers built in from about 2014. There's a second group who have to transition when the interest-only loan expires or try and get another interest-only loan. And we think there's a reasonable portion who actually will still meet the more stringent lending standards and can just continue on with interest-only. And there's a relatively small group. It's not insignificant, but there's a chunk which might have more difficulty translating into a principal and interest loan. So to summarise, our analysis suggests that most borrowers are actually okay. They'll either be able to continue their interest only or they'll be able to translate. There is a relatively small group that might have some more difficulties. So on balance, we don't think it's going to have a very big impact on credit or on consumption through that route.
We have a question here on the left at the back.
Hi, Michelle. This is Patrick Cummins from the Australian Financial Review.
Hi, Patrick.
Thanks very much for that speech. You said that changes to business models to address the risk of future misconduct could more permanently impact banks' financial performance. Could you perhaps expand on what changes specifically to business models, like maybe expand a little on that point to what you're thinking of in particular?
Sure. Well, some of it's happening already, and I mentioned that one of the reasons why profits haven't been going up is that there's been less non-interest income as banks have started to sell their wealth businesses in particular, their life insurance businesses, those sorts of things. So I think... So there's that sort of change in business model, the vertically integrated everything here sort of model. I think that's changing things, so that's having an impact. I highlighted the shift away from corporate lending into mortgage lending. the big banks all have very similar models now. They're very heavily weighted towards mortgage lending. Now, that's quite profitable at the moment, but if there's more competitors coming in there, then that might have an impact as well. As an aside, I would add that the fact that all the banks are so heavily weighted towards mortgage lending introduces a systemic component to the risk. So although housing lending itself is relatively safe and relatively well secured, the fact that everyone is so concentrated in that adds financial stability, risk. That's not quite the question you asked, but I think that's a point worth making. So I think really it's about seeing them restructure, and I think they might have to make some changes to the way they sell their products as well, which might impact as well. So there's a series of things, I think, that as I said, business at the particular business lines, the way they go about selling their business, the way they go back about competing, that will impact that.
Another one from the app. The Labor opposition party is going to the next election with a policy of removing negative gearing and reducing capital gains tax concessions for housing. Is this contributing to current weakness in house prices? Could this be something that turns the fall in house prices into something more severe?
So the Reserve Bank is on the record as saying that negative gearing and capital gains discount on housing is something that should be examined holistically in the context of taxation. So we're on the record as saying that. Will it impact... would an introduction of that impact now? I guess what I would highlight here is that at the moment, investor lending is not growing at all. So the impact of APRA's measures, the resulting increases in interest rates on investor and interest-only lending, and the tightening on lending standards have resulted, in fact, in a situation now where investor lending is not growing at all. And we haven't seen, in those circumstances, a complete tanking in the market. It's come off a bit, but as I said earlier, what you've seen is a bit of a switch towards owner-occupiers and first-home buyers, which is actually a positive thing. So I don't know the outcome. I'm not going to forecast what the outcome might be. I guess my point would be that we've already seen investor lending come off a long way, not growing, and we haven't seen a complete rout in the housing market. So I think that's probably a positive sign for the way you can bring investor lending off and not necessarily end up with problems in the housing market.
One more over there on the right.
Thank you, Michelle. Blockchain and cryptocurrencies have been part of the periphery discussions both at this conference and last week at Cybos when all the bankers were in town. Can you share how the RBA is deliberating on this technology or phenomenon and what sort of interaction you're having with other central banks about it?
Sure. So I probably won't say anything particularly new here. First point I would make is that cryptocurrencies from a financial stability perspective are just a non-event. They're small. We've all seen them go up in price and down in price. People that perhaps bought them at very high levels borrowing might now be experiencing problems. But banks aren't really exposed to them. It's quite a small market. So there's not a financial stability angle. I think a lot of the interest generated out of that has been more on the blockchain or distributed ledger technology. And there's also been a fair bit of conversation about whether central banks would in fact issue these things. Central bank digital currencies are not actually wedded to a blockchain. You can issue a central bank digital currency without involving blockchain or distributed ledger. The technology is separable from the point. So I think mainly where central banks around the world are thinking about this at the moment, there's a lot of interest in thinking about what might be the case for a central bank issuing a digital currency, whether that be on a blockchain or not. Some banks are looking at it more seriously than others. So the Swedish Central Bank, you probably know, is looking quite seriously at whether or not there might be a need for it, what its role might be. But I think broadly, most central banks around the world are are wondering what the use case is. We haven't been convinced yet that there is a use case for a central bank digital currency. In fact, I usually make the point, apologies to those who've heard me make it before, but in fact we do issue a digital currency. It's exchange settlement accounts at the Reserve Bank. That is central bank digital money. So generally what people are talking about in this context is, would we issue a central bank digital currency to, you know, us, you and me? And I think at that point the central banks are saying, pretty much around the world, we're not really convinced what the point is here, what the business case is, what problem are we trying to solve?
Okay, well, I think we've probably exhausted questions, but certainly our time. So just please join me in thanking Michelle for a great presentation.